Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor, where we transform my blog into an audio experience. I'm your host, MedPsych Moss, navigating healthcare as a patient and a future MD. Embark on a journey of vulnerability as we uncover the realities of trauma and developing resilience. Hit that follow and join us on this extraordinary life as a patient doctor. And now for the show. Today, I am interviewing Olivia, who's a third-year medical student passionate about normalizing sexual health conversations. Her motivation for becoming both a doctor and a sexual health advocate lies in her mission to champion underserved populations and enhance people's quality of life. She is a board member of the Idaho Association of Sexual Health Professionals and has taken part in initiatives, events, and research that aims to improve access to sexual health education in medical curriculum. You can find Olivia producing shame-free sex education and pre-med and medical student mentorship on social media. Welcome, Olivia.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to get to know you a little bit. Tell me a little bit about your background and journey into medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was raised in Bend, Oregon by my single dad with my little sister, and we grew up very poor, which has a lot to do with my journey to medicine. So my dad worked 12-hour days, 7 days a week to keep a roof over our head, but we, on a weekly basis, went to the food pantry, went to shelters so we would have warm coats. Every Christmas, we were donated presents from charities. We were donated turkeys for Thanksgiving. So every time you go to the grocery store and they're like, you want to donate to a family? That was me. And that was most of my childhood. And when I got to high school, we were actually homeless for a little bit and had to jump from friends' houses just to survive. And the summer before my sophomore year, my dad fell down a flight of stairs and suffered a traumatic brain injury. And so that's really when my journey to medicine started. That traumatic experience was actually life-saving for me in an odd way. I very much lived a woe is me kind of life when I was younger, and I was very depressed, had a lot of anxiety, had panic disorder. And that moment I was like, life's too short. You never know when you or someone you love more than anything is going to fall down a flight of stairs and almost die. And I realized in that moment that you can't control the experiences you have, but you can control how you react. And so from that moment on, I decided that that moment was something that happened for me and not to me. And I started to do a lot of volunteering, started to dabble in advocacy at that point. I was still very young, like 16 at the time. But I was like, if I can help anybody not experience these things or experience these things and cope with them better, then I would love to be that person for them. And so on top of working two jobs, working full-time through high school while taking care of my dad and trying to graduate high school, I was volunteering at the food shelter and started to do a little bit of legislative advocacy through a group called Results. And so I've been with them for several years, and their mission is to reduce poverty or help people in poverty find resources like food, shelter, mental health, all of that kind of stuff. Once I graduated high school, I got into a community college. That's when I decided, okay, I think I want to be a doctor. I don't know if I am good enough to be a doctor. And you'll hear that as kind of a recurring theme, even through med school, just the imposter syndrome of I have no business being here kind of thing. So I was taking the pre-med courses, not doing very well. I was a low stat pre-med. And then once I got my AA, I decided to take a year off and become a CNA. And that's when I realized for sure that I wanted to be a doctor. I loved taking care of patients. I loved having those intimate relationships, but I always wanted to do more for people because as a CNA or anybody who's not a physician, your scope of practice is very limited. And so I was like, okay, Olivia, pull up your big girl pants. We're going to do this no matter what anybody says. And so I went back to school, finished my bachelor's. Then I got a scribing position, and that solidified my decision to become a doctor. Once I saw somebody in the role, I was like, okay, I think I can do this. And more than anything, I want to do this. And so went for it. And as I talk a little bit on my social media, I bombed the MCAT twice. That's part of my low stat pre-med journey. The first time I took it, I got a 498. And the second time I took it, I got a 495. And up until that point, I had never heard of anybody doing worse on the second one and getting in. But I was like, you know what? I've worked so hard up until this point. I'm really confident in all my experiences and my story for why I want to be a physician. So I'm just going to send it. And I only applied to 3 schools because I knew that my chances were pretty slim with my MCAT. I didn't want to waste a bunch of money. And so I was like, okay, I will just apply to places I have connections. So I applied to a school in Oregon because I'm from Oregon. I applied to a school in Idaho, which is the one I'm currently at, because I've lived there for several years. And I applied to another school in the Pacific Northwest for similar reasons. I ended up getting interviews at all 3. I got denied at the one in Oregon, got waitlisted at the other 2, and then got accepted off both waitlists. And so it was just a really great full circle moment. And yeah, I don't regret any part of it.
That is beyond amazing. Everything you said, it reminds me of why I look up to you. And I know how so many other people on social media, and I'm sure who have met you in your school, look up to you. You are the exact reason why we need more doctors with all types of backgrounds. It's not just the elite affluent members. We need people from all versions of society, because I'm sure you, even right now as a third year medical student, bring your background or own experiences and connect with other students. Something you also mentioned was you were a CNA. I also was a caregiver. And so I love that. It is cool. That also brings in another shift of dynamic of seeing patients and that vulnerability. And it can definitely change how, also as a doctor, how you work with patients using that perspective. You also talked about a little bit of your challenges going into medical school work. What about challenges or triumphs, of course, in medical school? Tell me a little bit about once you got in.
Yeah. So again, like that recurring theme of imposter syndrome is something that I think we all absolutely deal with in some way, shape, or form. But that's definitely been my main challenge in med school. And especially when I started, because I was a low stat pre-med, I was like, I don't even know how to study. I don't even know what I'm doing. And thankfully, it only took me about a month to figure out what I was doing. I really took people's advice and went with the active recall, you know, study methods that everybody preaches, which I had never heard of as a pre-med. Wish I would have, but decided to implement those. And thankfully, I've done really well academically. I'm very fortunate. But again, it's that imposter syndrome that comes back. And, you know, especially when I became a second year, I was super concerned about Step 1 and Level 1 because I had bombed the MCAT twice. I just convinced myself that I was a bad test taker, especially a standardized test taker. And so it was actually something that I talked a lot about in therapy, because I was like, I don't believe that I'm going to be able to pass these exams. There's no data to show that I should be passing these exams, even though I was doing well in class. I just couldn't wrap my head around that. And so I kept convincing myself I was going to fail. And thank God for therapy, because I did not fail and I persevered. And that was a really monumental moment for me. Like, I don't think that for most students, it's a huge monumental event that they look back on and are like, yes, I passed Step 1 and Level 1, especially now that it's pass fail. You know, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I passed whatever. But I'm like, oh my gosh, I was so convinced that I had no business being here and that there was no way in heck I was going to pass either of those exams. So that was a challenge and a triumph for me. And then one thing that I actually have never talked to anybody about, but I was like, you know what, I'm going to talk to Stephanie about this. When I got into med school, I was 99% sure that I was going to be a family med doc. And because a lot of that is rooted in serving the underserved and providing the education, the advocacy for people like me and my family. But the more I started to learn and get involved, I was like, oh, I think I like other things. is that bad? Am I going to be able to advocate for the underserved? Am I going to be able to educate people if I pick anything but primary care? So I had a quarter life crisis, if you will, of like, what am I doing? Should I even be a doctor if I don't want to do primary care because of all the advocacy that I want to do? And thankfully, that mindset shifted. And I was like, well, you know what? No matter what specialty you're in, everybody needs advocacy. And there are underserved populations who need all kinds of care, not just primary care. And finding the sexual health stuff actually really helped shift my mindset too, because I was like, well, underserved, to me at least, doesn't just mean I don't have food, I don't have shelter. It also means I don't have resources to address my chronic medical conditions because people aren't educated about them. People aren't talking about them. And so that's where those two worlds of mine have collided. And I'm so glad that they did.
Amazing. I love that. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I definitely had the similar thing of having coming in being like, oh, I'm going to do family medicine. That is where the lower income people come in. That is a huge location, kind of like the first checkpoint. But you made a good point, is like, there are so many other specialties that need that additional advocacy, that needs those individuals that want to work with those populations, and being able to have that perspective is huge. Something that you mentioned that I wanted to bring back is like the feeling of looking at the evidence. It triggered in my mind because that's something my therapist in medical school always says, look at the evidence, look at the evidence. But in your example, you are looking at the evidence. You're looking at the evidence that you did not do well. I'm not going to say fail, because you obviously did not fail because you made it. You made it into medical school. And so maybe that is the evidence. The evidence is you got in, or you've passed all your first year blocks that now allow you to take step one. And I feel like I keep like going back to that when I have my own imposter syndrome. Like you said, it's looking at the evidence. Okay, well, where, even if I've failed at things, where did I originally keep going? Where did I end up passing? And that's kind of been the way that I've been able to keep going and fight that imposter syndrome. I'm working on a research project about low income and first generation students, and imposter syndrome is one of the biggest things that we're seeing that individuals are struggling with. Like you said, it perpetuates this negativity of themselves that might actually lead them to not do as well, because they're so focused on, oh, everyone else is going to believe that I'm not going to do well, or I don't believe I'm going to do well. And so that is definitely something we need to combat, is giving people those role models or the possibility that you can make it. Whatever you struggle with, like, it is possible. You can keep doing that. Up to this point, you said, okay, you're in third year right now. How has things been kind of this year as you've transitioned from the study mode, step one, to now being with patients?
Yeah. So actually, for me, it's been the smoothest transition. I feel like I'm actually finally where I'm meant to be. You know, obviously not to the scope we want to be yet, because I'm not the one in charge of patient care, but it's just a whole different ball game. Like, being able to apply everything we've learned in a patient setting is everything I ever dreamed of. And so I, you know, a lot of people, at least a lot of people I talked to, were like, third year is so hard. It's so grueling. And that's true. You have to go to work 12 hours, and then you have to come home and study because you still have tests. And that's very true. But for me, at least, it's been so much more fulfilling. And I don't feel nearly as tired as I did first and second year, because I'm getting that energy from talking to patients and that motivation from talking to patients that I didn't get first and second year. So it was a much smoother transition from second to third than pre-med to first year.
While speaking with patients, how has your unique perspective that you mentioned earlier, how has that shifted the dynamic of how you interact with patients or with your fellow medical students and residents? Have you noticed there being any difference?
I don't get to see a lot of how my peers interact with patients, because I tend to be with my preceptors one-on-one, so I can't speak for any specific differences there, but I can tell you that my background has definitely played a role in how I approach patient care. And I feel like personally, I notice and pay a lot of attention to the psychosocial aspects of patient care because I know what it was like to not have those needs met. And I emphasize quality of life a lot, which I don't know how my peers approach that, but just with the experiences I've had, I definitely optimize quality of life because that was not something that was ever optimized for me and my family, especially when my dad had suffered that traumatic brain injury. They were basically, at least it felt like they were thinking, well, he's alive, so that's all that matters. They didn't think that his 16-year-old daughter was going to have to be his primary caregiver. His 16-year-old daughter was going to have to be head of household and work full-time during high school. Nobody thought of those things, and nobody provided us the resources we needed to avoid that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't regret it at all. I think it's made me the person I am today. But if I could help another 16-year-old not have to do that, then that would be amazing. And so those are the kinds of things that I always consider when talking to patients. They're not just a medical, biological condition. They're a human being with a story.
Love that, with a story and the whole family. How do you think mm-hmm. you're going to be able to do that in your future profession? Is there kind of a unique spin? Because I'm thinking family medicine, people more think of, okay, now I can talk about the family, or now I can pay attention to other family members or other dynamics. How do you see yourself doing that in your specialty of choice?
Yeah, for sure. And this is, again, something I haven't really talked about out loud, so you get to be the first one. I'm just giving you all the new info. So I have decided to apply urology, and I think the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question is the quality of life aspect. So, you know, a lot of people with urologic conditions have a quality of life issue. Like, I would say 50% or more of the people that I saw on my urology rotation had urinary incontinence. And people were afraid to leave the house. They would come into the office, tears rolling down their face because they were so embarrassed by their condition. They felt like they couldn't do any of the things that they enjoyed anymore. And so having that experience of nobody paying attention to mine and my family's quality of life has made me recognize that these things are critical for people and that these are things that I really want to prioritize for people. Having urinary incontinence or having sexual dysfunction, anything that affects quality of life, absolutely affects your family, your friends, because those people, like the example I just gave, don't want to leave their house. They're not going to go see their family. They're not going to go hang out with their friends because they're afraid to pee their pants. And that's something that we need to be educating everybody about, but this person and their family about, because it's really lonely to go through conditions that affect quality of life as well, because they don't feel like they can talk to people. And so education, that advocacy for quality of life, is something that I'm really looking forward to for urology.
Amazing. What are your thoughts on breaking down stereotypes? You mentioned sexual health, and it sounds like that might be another one of your unique passions. Could you talk a little bit about breaking down the stereotypes through talking about sexual health, especially on social media, which is definitely not well talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. The stigma of sexual health has a lot to do with that underserved component. That's why I consider people with sexual dysfunction underserved. Because of the stigma, because we're not talking about it, they're not getting the resources that they need or want. There are so many stereotypes, so many stigmas, so much diversity work that needs to happen in the medical field, even outside of sexual health, obviously. It's so important to have somebody who is willing to advocate for those issues.
Actually, I never even thought of that perspective of seeing individuals who struggle with sexual health mm-hmm. as marginalized another aspect of diversity.
Yeah, so I absolutely believe that not only are people with sexual dysfunction considered underserved, they do kind of fall into that marginalized group, though, and that falls into a diversity issue. And, you know, I also like urology because there's often a lot of older people who need urologic care. And from my perspective and working as a CNA, working in an internal medicine clinic, people who are elderly are often somewhat marginalized as well. And I think that all falls into my motivation and my passion to advocate for these underserved communities.
Can you talk about the population of people who go to urology? Because I remember before being in medicine, I always thought that urology was just for male thing. But then you're talking about incontinence, you're talking about older adults, and then you're talking about sexual health. So for those of us who aren't as familiar with urology, what are the types of things that, why would someone go to urology?
Great question. And you know, that's another reason that I love urology is because the demographic is so diverse. I think it is a big misconception that people hear urology and they're like, you only deal with penis owners. And that's absolutely not true. At least when I was on my urology rotation, I saw the same amount of men as I saw women. And I actually saw a lot of older individuals, and whether that's because I'm in rural Idaho, possibly, and they're not specialized, they're general urologists. I'm sure that has something to do with the demographics that I saw, but I saw 6-year-olds, I saw 20-year-olds, I saw 90-year-olds. And I even saw transgender folks. I was a part of gender affirming care in that aspect. And so it's just one of the many reasons I love urology. I love the wide demographic.
That's amazing. Thank you. I had no idea. That is definitely great to hear for someone who is interested in working with that demographic or those type of issues. That might be a great opportunity. We've talked about so many things today. Do you have any advice for other medical students or any current, even other health professional students that are looking into medicine or struggling through medicine? Do you have any things that you'd like to provide advice from your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the number one piece of advice that I do give people, and I want to give anybody listening to this, is to be happy now. The arrival fallacy is something that I have always struggled with, and I think a lot of us in medicine struggle with. You know, the I'll be happy once I get accepted into medical school. I'll be happy once I get into residency. I'll be happy once I'm an attending. And life is just so miserable when you live it that way. And, you know, when my dad had that TBI, that was kind of the turning moment for me to realize, oh, I need to be happy now, because not a day that I have is ever guaranteed. So I think you really need to go in with that perspective. And I think there's a lot of benefit in romanticizing the little parts of life, especially as a pre-med and in medical school. The journey is hard. It's grueling. It can be really lonely sometimes. Finding joy in that cup of coffee you had while studying, or the warm blanket you have while watching Sketchy, you know, are the things that really keep you going and keep you excited.
Those are really helpful. Thank you. I do want to mention at the very beginning, you mentioned some sort of study technique. I couldn't remember what it was called, but I've never heard of it.
I think I was talking about active recall. So
yeah, what is that?
Just focusing on active study techniques. So what I mean by that is doing things like practice questions, things that force you to bring what you've learned or the things you've stored in your memory out and apply them in a real situation. And I consider Anki an active recall as well, because it's something that, again, you have to forcibly pull out of your brain. It's not something like reading where you're just passively looking over stuff that you studied, because that's not how your brain is going to long-term remember that information. And that was a lot of what I did as a pre-med. I would just read, take notes, read my notes, and hope for the best. And that's not a good way to remember things, especially long-term. And when you get into medical school, everything needs to be long-term. You have to remember so much information, and you have to remember it for a long time. So those active recall study techniques are really critical.
That's helpful. Thank you. You mentioned earlier that you were struggling a lot with your mental health, with all the stuff that was going on in your life in pre-med. Did specific techniques that you learned before medicine, or even new techniques during medical school, help you?
A lot of it comes back again to that arrival fallacy and the romanticizing little things. And those are things that you obviously have to be very intentional about. You're not just going to wake up and think, oh yeah, today's the greatest day, even though I studied 80 hours this week, whatever. It's something that you have to constantly remind yourself of and work towards. And having a routine and doing stuff that takes care of your brain, along with romanticizing those little moments, is what helps me get through. So, you know, every morning I try and eat something before I drink coffee. I'm getting better at that this year anyway. And I take time to not be on my phone and to think about at least five things that I'm grateful for. And I've gotten much better at that. But when I first started, it was, you know, it would take me 20 minutes to find five things I was grateful for. And so just those little things that add up over time, you don't have to do some dramatic thing to alter your mental health. It's really those daily consistent actions that have a long-term effect.
Those are great suggestions. I'll write those down. For individuals who want to get in contact with you and kind of learn more and follow your journey, how can people follow you or get in contact with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Instagram and Twitter, I am at Olivia A. Paulson. And for anybody who has specific questions or wants to get in contact with me individually, you can email me at livapaulson@gmail.com.
Amazing. Thank you, Olivia. I'll make sure to include that below. You can find me at MedPsychMoss on all social media platforms. You can get more information on mental health resources, some of them that Olivia recommended and some other ones that I've combined and consolidated during my own experience on MedPsychMoss.com. If you'd like to learn more, you can find my podcast on both video and audio. Anywhere you get your podcasts, that includes Spotify, Amazon, Apple Music, YouTube. Thank you so much, Olivia. I look forward to seeing you on your journey.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
It was great talking to you. Bye-bye.